All right, Daniel, let's start by introducing our audience to yourself as well as to Comcast Ventures.
Great. So I'm currently a principal at Comcast Ventures based here in San Francisco, and I focus 100% of my time on seed and early stage investments in consumer internet companies. So, about half of my work is in kind of e-commerce marketplaces, and the other half is kind of everything else within consumer internet. So digital media, social media, mobile, AR, AI, et cetera. And so, prior to joining Comcast Ventures, I was actually on the operating side. So I started my career as a consultant at BCG and then went on to start a company called FashionStake, which was a marketplace for independent fashion that was venture-backed, which got acquired by Fab.com. And then we went and ran Fab.com's fashion business, which was their largest vertical at the time. And so, definitely have been around the e-commerce world for, almost 10 years now and have sort of translated that operating experience to the deal side. As far as Comcast Ventures goes, we've got one LP, and that is Comcast NBC. But we're a separate group that focuses first and foremost on working with great entrepreneurs and investing in, world-changing companies, no matter what the vertical or sector. And so we're investing across the consumer and enterprise spectra. Myself, I'm just focused on consumer and pure consumer investments. But as a fund, we, pretty much touch every area of tech. And so, I think a lot of people maybe have a mental sort of think of us as maybe media focused or advertising focused, ad tech or infrastructure focused, and actually that couldn't be further from the truth. We're just looking to work with great entrepreneurs and invest in the next huge companies.
So tell me a little bit about your firm's focus in terms of stage. And if you could give us some fairly, specific details of exactly what point do you want to come in, whether it's when it's B2C, what stage do you like to come in? When it's B2B, what stage do you like to come in?
Absolutely. So maybe some historical context here would be helpful. So historically, let's call it 2011, 2012, we tended to be a little bit later stage. So we used to come in sort of Series B, Series C. We would do the odd Series A, but on average, it was a later stage operation where, an entrepreneur would show up with traction and a company that was sort of scaling and had already, been built from an initial team perspective. And that's when we would really come in with an investment. Over the last 5 years, we've really gotten to be a much earlier stage investor. So we still invest in, Series C plus rounds, right? Where a market has formed. There are a few market leaders, and we're, trying to pick a winner in that market that has kind of already formed. But we're increasingly making investments, and this is certainly my focus, where it is, a founder with an idea turning up with, a pitch deck and wanting to raise that first round of institutional capital. And so, and the reason that we've trended earlier is a couple of reasons. One is we just find that getting into business with entrepreneurs early has a ton of both financial upside, obviously, but also kind of firm cred and sort of relationship upside. So, we're investors, early investors in a company called Away, which is as an example, which is a direct-to-consumer travel brand. That just announced their Series B. And, we're able to, fund that company when it was, two founders and an idea, and really help that company through the last kind of year and a half, 2 years of its of its life, and really develop that relationship with the founding team and the executive team over there. And we just find that not only does that help our kind of ROI math on the fund, you know, if we can make these early stage investments really really sing, it also you know, has great kind of knock-on benefits for Comcast Ventures in the community, right? So where, you know, other entrepreneurs, when they've got choices of who to take funding from, you know, at the early stage, you know, we want to be out there and we want to be top of mind for the best consumer and enterprise entrepreneurs. And I think the only way you do that is you really stick your neck out and support the community and support these entrepreneurs early on. And so, you know, I think, you know, as we sit here today in 2017, we're pretty much sector and stage agnostic. I mean, I think we truly, you know, we can truly write a, you know, 150K check at the seed, and that's something that we'll do, all the way up to a, you know, $15 million plus check, you know, pre-IPO. And so it's something that we're proud of. It's something that we will continue to do. You know, it's something that to date has sort of worked out well. So.
And is there a counterpart of yours on the enterprise side who also deals with seed stage investments in the B2B businesses?
Yeah. So we there are actually two relevant streams there. So we have a sister fund that we are an LP in called Genicast Ventures, and they are based on the East Coast, and they're focused purely on companies also based on the East Coast. It's led by a guy, Gil Bader, who was a former, you know, seasoned entrepreneur, successful entrepreneur. And, you know, Genicast will go in and really try to lead the best B2B investments on the East Coast. We've also got another, one of my colleagues by the name of Kai Bond. He focuses more on sort of enterprise and frontier tech based out of the New York office. And so we sort of have those two streams on the enterprise side.
But in Silicon Valley, you do not have an enterprise investor in the seed stage.
We don't have a formal, it's not to say we wouldn't make an investment there, but no, typically we don't. In Silicon Valley, we don't have someone located here. Kai Bond would be the one that would sort of take that deal. But, you know, obviously he's based in New York, so.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about electronic commerce specifically, since we are in the context of that sector of the economy in this interview. Talk to me about how you analyze the electronic commerce universe sitting in 2017.
Yeah.
What are the key trends that you are observing, and how are you interpreting those to decide where you would place bets given where we are right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think of commerce just like any other sector, which kind of happens in waves, right? And so I think wave one in, you know, the early 2000s was, let's just get product online, right? Let's just get product online. Let's get as much product online as we can, and let's kind of work through the consumer trepidation around transacting online. I mean, people forget that, like, in the early 2000s, it was actually a bit of a big deal to put your credit card into a browser and actually transact. Security was a big thing. And so kind of phase one was sort of putting everything online. Phase two, which kind of arguably started with Gilt Group in 2007, was really, okay, now that people are comfortable transacting online, and now that there's kind of this sea of product available online, it really was kind of, I think of it as kind of e-commerce as a sport, right? Other people call it discovery and discovery-based e-commerce. And, you know, in that phase, we really saw this group of companies, you know, Gilt Group, Fab.com, you know, that crop of company, where it was really about, entertaining the consumer, showing the consumer product that had some urgency wrapped around it, right? If you remember the daily deal sites where, you know, you'd have 24-hour, 48-hour flash sales and kind of the product would be taken away afterwards. And, you know, a new wave of kind of front-end user experience, right? So at Fab, you know, we, I think, you know, for all of the issues on the business side, you know, the shopping, the core shopping experience, the core browsing experience was actually, you know, I think best practice and a pretty delightful experience, right? You had, you know, really rich photography and video, right? You had the ability to, you know, see products that were tailored to you, right? It felt like you were reading a, you know, almost like a design magazine or something versus kind of shopping. And so it was sort of this next gen, you know, user experience that I think sort of set the stage for today's company. So that was wave two, was this kind of discovery based shopping. And then kind of the wave that we're in now or that started after that was really around mobile, right? And so we've seen you know, we've seen it tip from, you know, 5 to 10% of e-commerce to more like 30%. And, you know, the dollars are a little bit behind the views, right? So conversion rates on mobile tend to be a little bit lower and average order values tend to be a little bit lower. But, you know, for any e-commerce site today, you know, you're looking at a baseline of at least 50% of your e-commerce eyeballs, at least, are coming from mobile. And sometimes it's more like 75 to 85%. Right. And so when you think about how to sell a, you know, $10 product in that environment where you've got kind of limited real estate and the shopper, the consumer is probably kind of has their attention in six other places and, you know, it's kind of doable, right? But when you think about, you know, an item that is a $200, $300, $400 kind of high consideration purchase, you know, I think folks are still trying to figure out how to effectively convert that consumer in a mobile environment where real estate on screen is limited and you know, you can't show up with 30, you know, videos and photos and, you know, pages of product description. So but I think there are some really interesting, you know, we're in a company called Holla that does that really well. It's kind of an online dollar store concept. Hush is a great company that sells beauty in that format really, really well. And there are obviously others, but, you know, you're really seeing this wave of kind of mobile native kind of retailers. And so that's kind of the historical context, at least as I see it. You know, I think all of us in the e-com world, you know, obviously have, you mentioned Amazon, have Amazon, you know, front and center. And I think what's changed with Amazon is, you know, historically with Amazon, you used to be able to say, you used to be able to sort of redline categories and areas that were quote unquote Amazon proof, right? So you used to be able to say, you know, fashion specifically, oh, Amazon's a really intent-based environment and doesn't do really well on discovery. And so they're never really going to get, you know, fashion and the inspiration, the emotional connection around buying a, you know, $300 dress online, right? The other thing you would say is you'd say on the grocery front, you know, Amazon would never, you know, they don't have a fresh supply chain, right? It was non-perishables and they're, you know, they're great at selling, you know, books and gadgets, and but they're never going to nail the fresh supply chain. And, you know, I think this, you know, I could go on, but I think this idea of kind of being Amazon proof is kind of fading away, right? And so if you look at actually specifically within fashion, like Amazon actually has a bunch of leading, you know, quote unquote direct to consumer fashion brands now, right?
Absolutely.
Both in the men's and women's space. You know, Amazon now has a sort of direct analogy to Stitch Fix with wardrobe. And so, you know, we're sort of past this world where you can categorically say that Amazon is not gonna enter my market. That said, I think that, you know, you either believe two states, you know, one of two things is going to be true, right? Either Amazon goes and takes near 100% market share of e-commerce, right? Or there will be, you know, they'll take less and there'll be room for other big players to emerge. Like one of those two states of the world is true. And I think that, you know, the thing with Amazon is you still can point to one core sort of belief that at least I have as an e-commerce investor, which is, you know, if I shop on Amazon, that is a generic sort of mass market. This is at this point a ubiquitous, you know, store, right? And really, me shopping at Amazon and transacting on Amazon gives the world zero sense of who I am as a consumer, right? Whereas if I go and I shop on, you know, if I buy a piece of luggage from Away or, you know, glasses from Warby Parker, or if I'm a holler consumer, you know, that is a kind of lifestyle and brand that I'm buying into that is not Amazon. And I think that, you know, specifically in the direct consumer world, you know, I think Amazon has the balance sheet and the team to go out and spin up, you know, 100 brands, 200 brands, you know, maybe more, in fashion and in consumer durables and in any other category that they want to be in. But are they going to be able to deliver the customer experience and delight that, you know, a Casper, which we're not invested in, does, right? So are they going to be able to, you know, at each consumer touch point, on the physical packaging side, you know, on the marketing messaging side, you know, Casper has this fantastic sort of quirky, you know, advertising sort of style where, you know, they use these handwritten ads. You would have seen them in the subway if you're in New York, and they're just so well messaged, right? The emails that you get from Casper as a consumer, every single email that you get is just so well crafted. The copy is so just on point, you know. And then sort of post purchase, you know, the 100-day return policy, being able to call up and speak to someone on the phone straight away, right? So you know, I think that there's a difference between sort of the perception of, hey, Amazon's coming into my market and they're launching X, versus, you know, really understanding the consumer in the vertical that you're in and being able to sort of tailor a product or an experience or both to that consumer. You know, I that's something that Amazon, I think, will have to compete with, you know, at least in the D2C world, compete with other brands on, right? And I think that, you know, if I need to go out and buy a mattress, you know, Casper at this point is, you know, one of the sort of names that come into mind first when I'm thinking about doing that. And, you know, I think if Amazon wants to go out and you know, launch their own private label mattresses, you know, I think they'll have to compete with Casper doing that. And so, you know, I think long-winded way of saying, I think the direct-to-consumer world is a world that we're still very excited about as investors. I think it's a 10-year, decade-long transformation that incumbent CPGs and brands will have to negotiate, right, on the e-commerce side. You know, for the longest time, a lot of these brands were holding out on e-commerce, and now they're realizing that, you know, the consumer wants to transact that way. And I think, quite frankly, a lot of them are stuck when it comes to sort of the core capabilities and DNA around e-commerce. And so they're going to have to make acquisitions, and they're going to have to, and we've seen a few already, you know, Walmart has been very aggressive on that front very early on. And, you know, I think this is the start of a sort of decade-long transition from sort of incumbent brand to sort of digital-first brand. And so, you know, that's one example where, you know, all is not lost and there are still big companies that will be built. But for sure, we're seeing Amazon definitely gain steam, and it's something that, you know, any e-commerce company, any brand, any retailer is thinking about, you know, today. So
let me respond to what you said. I've obviously thought about this quite a lot, as you have. My observation is that, you kind of have to have a private label brand to compete with Amazon at this point. In whatever category that you're working in, you need a product that you can differentiate with. You can't really differentiate on the basis of other people's product that easily, unless you get some sort of an exclusivity from other designers or other product conceptualizers. The user experience is part of that differentiation, absolutely. Casper and all the mattresses, there are like a lot of mattress brands right now. Online mattress is in a tier. But I think the user experience is something that I wouldn't put it past Amazon to be able to win on. So I think somewhere there needs to be a product level differentiation. The user experience is a secondary differentiator.
That's certainly the default consensus view today, right? So that's certainly the view that I think most take. The contrarian view is actually, and I've spoken about this before. I mean, if you look at the outsized e-commerce exits, right? Zappos, most recently Jet, although Jet was very much an outlier. Chewy.com, right? That just sold for $3 billion plus. If you actually look at the data, kind of the outsized exits in e-com, at least historically, have been multi-brand retailers, right?
That's not where we are in 2017. Today, if you look at companies starting out today or our small companies today, I think there are multi-brand retailers are to scale to at a venture scale pace, I think is going to be very difficult.
Unless there's a platform shift, right, that kind of changes the game. So I'm looking at things like, so I totally agree with you that starting a web-based, Chewy.com competitor or whatever, it's just not the right time to do that. That said, the consumer always wins here, right? So if the consumer suddenly, I'm looking at voice, for example, I'm looking at VR-based shopping environments, right? I'm looking at things like chat-based, conversational environments where these transactions take place. WeChat, in China, I think is a great example of kind of mixing, text with actual commerce. And we can go on. I think actually the blockchain is really interesting. So that is true given a static platform environment, but if we see a platform shift like mobile, right, and it's kind of unclear sitting here today, at least to me, what that exactly looks like. I actually think AR, Apple's AR kit, I think opens up all sorts of really interesting shopping opportunities for app developers and consumers. If we see a fundamental shift in the platform, in the underlying platforms where consumers kind of spend time, that's really exciting to me. And trying to anticipate that shift is, I think, what I'm spending time on, because we've just sort of seen time and time again throughout all these waves of history that, the incumbents, no matter how strong at the time, are slow to these platform shifts, right? And so, I would bet that if VR suddenly became, fulfilled its promise and, people were starting to transact in that environment, that someone like an Amazon would be obviously aware of that, but, a startup would be nimble enough to be able to sort of land grab there on that new platform.
I agree with you on VR, AR being presenting opportunities for serious differentiation. These are also very heavy technology investments. If you want to have a differentiated proprietary platform in AR, VR, and obviously the biggest application of that is in fashion and visual merchandising type of environments, whether it's home furnishings or whatever, but definitely the biggest is fashion. I think that is an opportunity. It is See, the thing that we see in the early stages, and this is where what you said earlier about your interest in working with seed stage companies or pre-seed companies is kind of interesting to me, that today, you know, everybody, even the pre-seed seed investors, want to see somewhat validated businesses. They're not willing to really invest in companies that are concept stage. So
yeah.
It is very, very difficult for, you know, entrepreneurs to bootstrap a very big technology investment, you know, in AR, VR, whatever, and you know, prove that they can even validate that they can actually sell fashion through something like that, that kind of an environment,
so let me, yeah.
And show that differentiation.
Yeah, so on that point, and I do want to go back to the Amazon thing just in a second, but on that particular point, I mean, we've made, I think at this point, 6 or 7 VR investments, all of which, except for one, were seed investments. You know, of the investments, I've made 9 investments since joining Comcast Ventures. I think, you know, at least 4 of them were pre-product, pre-revenue. So I think generally what you're saying has some truth in that, you know, I think the bar for traction, you know, has gone up a little bit on average, and, you know, Series A investors want to see, you know, more than what they did a decade ago. But I think you've just got to find the right investor, right? So like for me, you know, I, you know, if I'm excited about a space and a team and a concept, like, you know, I've got, and we as a fund have no problem, you know, funding that concept and that entrepreneur. You know, on the other hand, if someone shows up with, you know, $10 million in monthly revenue in a category in a space that we don't, you know, care about, then, you know, we're not gonna, you know, fund that entrepreneur. And so I think, you know, I think generally that statement is true, but I think it's really important. And this kind of hits on, you know, entrepreneur or investor fit, right? You really got to find the investor or the sets of investors that are going to, you know, help you in both kind of in the stage that you're at, you know, at the current time, but also going forward. And, you know, again, like we love to meet entrepreneurs, you know, in the earliest parts of company and idea formation. And, you know, we will step up with a check where we love the opportunity in the team. So that I just wanted to sort of focus in on that. I do want to double back just once to the, because we talked about Amazon and D2C was really, you know, one of the pieces on, you know, how can you sort of compete in this Amazon dominant world. I think there's another vector here, which is we're investing actually a lot and thinking a lot about the offline, online shopping sort of a trail that the consumer, you know, increasingly is leading, right? So starting in store, converting online, you know, researching online, coming into a store to induce trial, you know, going back and converting online. And so the paths to conversion are increasingly looking like, you know, like pieces of spaghetti, right? Where consumers will, you know, you have this sort of multi-touch concept, you know, of a consumer before they actually purchase. And so, you know, we've invested in a company called Beta, which is kind of redefining redefining what a store is. It's redefining the concept of a store. And we've got a couple of other investments that haven't been announced that are really around how do you as a retailer leverage your physical footprint, right? And how does your physical footprint intersect intelligently with your online business? And what are the tools and all the picks and shovels around that? And how do you kind of wrap all of that in one coherent experience for the consumer? I think, you know, Walmart, you know, just announced that, you know, your offline purchase history is available online now. I mean, that's a huge, you know, considering that, you know, offline is still the lion's share of retail, right? You know, if I'm able to infer and show you product online that, you know, takes into account your offline shopping behavior, you know, that's a huge advantage. And I think, you know, you saw the Whole Foods deal obviously last week, you know, I think Amazon's, you know, by definition, weak in that area, right? You know, Amazon Go, you know, is obviously a huge initiative for them, and Whole Foods was their biggest acquisition ever. But if I was a retailer today, you know, and certainly as investors, we're thinking through, you know, what are the tools? How do we really leverage that physical footprint? How do we repurpose our stores to become not just kind of holders of inventory, but, you know, experiences in and of themselves? And how do we leverage the data that we're collecting in, you know, 80, 90% of, you know, commerce transactions, which is offline? How do we leverage that knowledge and that know-how to be stronger kind of overall? And so, you know, that's an area that I think is clearly, you know, and Amazon learns really quickly, so let's see. But certainly as a retailer today, I think, you know, that's where I'd be focusing.
You know, the part of retail that I find very interesting, and this is, I think, outside of the scope of venture capital, because I don't think these kinds of companies are going to grow at venture scale, is more the niche, you know, and let's take the example of fashion. I don't wear as much, you know, big designers anymore. I wear some of the big designers, but I also shop a lot when we are traveling in esoteric places, esoteric designers that don't have big footprints, that maybe have, you know, three stores in Brussels, Avenue Louise, and you know, Paris, maybe Galerie Vivienne and stuff like that. And these kinds of things sitting in San Francisco are just not accessible. So if there's a small retailer that assembles and really, really well merchandises a group of designers and a group of products that are really special and really interesting, that kind of curation has tremendous value. But it's a small market. This is a very esoteric market. This is not a mass market at all.
Absolutely. And I think curation is really the value of curation, I think, is kind of overlooked and underrated. I mean, curation is actually really done well is a very, very unique skill, particularly as you grow. I mean, we at Fab sort of went through this phase where, you know, Fab started off as a very tightly curated sort of design store with, you know, 50 SKUs, 100 SKUs on the site at any given time, right? And that felt very thoughtful. And I think some of the issues that you face as an e-commerce retailer, at least as you want to grow, is sort of expanding range, right? So more categories, more product in each category. And I think when you do that, you know, you sort of trade off. Yeah, you trade off that sense of customer delight for sort of short-term conversion. And you're right, it does end up being sort of an everything store that actually no one really set out to be. But so I remember one day I looked at the site and, you know, it was just, I mean, it looked more like, you know, Walmart.com than, you know, anything that we had kind of really set out to be. And so you've just got to be really, really careful with...
And that's the environment. That heavily curated environment is where a very special user experience, highly deeply personalized user experience can be provided, should be provided, will be appreciated, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a very different business. That is not a venture scale business, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I think, so a couple thoughts on that. One is, you know, I think we've done a lot of these companies a massive disservice by funding them like they are technology companies, right? So, you know, I think that there are great e-commerce companies and great brands being built today that are fantastic, you know, $200 to $500 million companies, which, you know, in the grand scheme of companies is an incredible, incredible feat, particularly in the time that it takes to get these guys to that scale, which is, you know, often just a few years. So, but, you know, us as venture capitalists, I think, have a responsibility, you know, not to overcapitalize these companies and really not to think about e-commerce revenue as equivalent to, you know, paid content or SaaS revenue that has zero COGS, right? And so, you know, we I think on the investing side need to take a good hard look at some of these companies because, you know, I'm speaking for, you know, for Fab specifically, you know, that would have been a great $500 million company, right? The thing that
was overcapitalized big time, just by overfunding.
Totally. The thing that killed it was suddenly you try to be this $10 billion company and it just doesn't work that way. And
it's not structured. That Nasty Gal fiasco was the same story. It was not structurally possible to get it to those kinds of levels. It was doing very nicely and it should have been capitalized much more modestly and the company would have still been alive and it was a good entrepreneur. Now we'll look at this story. It's ridiculous.
Totally. And so I think we're in this sort of new era on the venture side of we recognize that there are some really interesting opportunities here, but we really want to be thoughtful about moderating capital in. And so, you know, that is it's this new era of, I think, you know, fiscal, not conservatism, but stewardship that I think people are aware of now, given some of the sort of high profile failures that have happened. But I do want to go back to this idea of curation. So, you know, because I think it's a really important sort of core piece of the e-commerce story. So, you know, curation historically has been very much around, you know, a buyer and a category and that buyer, you know, making decisions on a category basis. I mean, that's still how it happens. Yeah, and, you know, I think we're, you know, injecting more and more data into those decisions, but you know, when I think about curation in the retailers that I know and have been involved with, you know, even to today, you know, it kind of looks like that, right? You know, I think curation tomorrow, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, potentially looks very different, right? And so when you think about the data that exists on that's just out there on product sales and when you look at sort of the fragmentation of brands that's happening, and when you look at some of these new sort of AI technologies, machine learning technologies that can really process data at scale, it's crazy to me that, you know, someone at Walmart who is in charge of, you know, the pet category is just kind of going out making these, you know, buying decisions based on, you know, historical sales and some combination of historical sales and gut feel, right, at the end of the day. And so I think that whole concept of what do I curate? You know, what do I buy and show, you know, to my consumer, I think will radically change over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think a lot more data, external data, will be infused into those decisions. And I think as an interesting thought experiment, it'd be really interesting to, you know, spin up a store and have a robot curate, right? I've always wanted to do this as like a weekend.
I don't know if you read, since you read my blog, you may have read my articles on this subject, especially in the context of fashion, because I did the first e-commerce company in fashion with exactly this premise that it needs to be a personalized store. So curation is very possible to do but you have to use technology in the back end, and that is a very expensive technology to build.
Totally. I didn't read that particular article, but you know, I think the point is I think we're moving away from sort of gut and more towards some of these more analytical techniques. I think, you know, so curation being both a left brain and right brain exercise as opposed to just a sort of emotional decision. And then I think on the consumer side, you know, there are some really interesting you know, apps that I looked at an app called Lily. That's really interesting, which provides really, really deep recommendations on, I mean, they happen to be in fashion, but it could be multi-category where, you know, you really get to know the consumer. In Lily's case, they go and ask a series of questions, kind of a survey-like approach. But then they go through and they actually have, you know, many, many product attributes for each SKU that they carry. So think about it as like a Pandora for fashion in that they can sort of tag these products with very specific attributes. So things like, you know, what is the stretchiness of the waistband? You know, like very, very detailed attributes that 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 you know no retailer or brand currently has. You know, if I do that, so if I put you know what I know about you as a consumer together with very very deep product attribution, you know, can I you know essentially give you the best recommendations that you will ever get, right? And I think you know some of these apps, you know, there are more. You know, the return rates are really low, right? So you're looking at, you know, in fashion, we see category average return rates of anywhere between 20 to 30%. You know, a lot of these apps are generating return rates that are, you know, fractions of that, right? Because of the value of these recommendations. And so, you know, is that something that Amazon can do? You know, I think certainly, you know, their recommendations have been primarily based on, you know, browser click-through data and purchase data, and that gets you to a certain level. But I think the depth of those recommendations, I think you're gonna see a host of companies really tackle, you know, how do we do, you know, very, very deep recommendations. I think that's...
Daniel, look up my writings on this subject since you're so passionate about it. This is probably the topic about fashion e-commerce that I've written about the most just because that's what I did. It's, you know, it is the unexplored territory in fashion, partly because you need both deep computer science and deep understanding of fashion to come together in one person who is the entrepreneur, at least in one founding team. And that is not easy to find. You know, the geeks are not the most fashionable people in the world. And and then the second thing is it is an expensive technology to build. And given what is happening in venture capital today, it's all, you know, largely lean startups, right? Venture capitalists are moving further and further away, and you made a case that you are doing something different. You're trying to do something different, but by and large, the industry is moving far and far away upstream, and entrepreneurs have to, you know, build things for lean. And these are the kinds of things that cannot be built for so lean. These are more fast startups kind of scenarios. So I think that's one of the things that's standing on the way of entrepreneurs who even might be, you know, able to do. So my actually feedback to you is if you're really passionate about this particular problem, try to find an entrepreneur and an entrepreneur's team where computer science and fashion/style meets and try to do a fast startup there. That's how this problem can be cracked.
I think that's right. And I think just to provide some, because you've touched on this a couple of times now, so I want to address it. This idea that, you know, the technology build is expensive and how do you get around that? You know, assuming you're not one of the entrepreneurs that, you know, has a, you know, you've sold a company for $300 million in the past and can walk in and get a, you know, term sheet for $8 million seed round. Like, if you're not one of those people, kind of how do you go about this?
That's right.
And I think I think just to be constructive here, I think the way that you have a shot at getting around it is to try to, I think about this concept of like the sort of digestible milestones, right, when I'm funding a company. So I think about this concept of like, you know, round size is X and what do we want to achieve? You know, what does X get us? In terms of bias, in terms of milestones, and how do we, you know, are they the right milestones, and do those milestones de-risk the business, you know, for the next round? So like that's the framework here. And so, you know, if it's going to take you, $20 million to produce a, you know, hardware prototype, you know, a VR hardware prototype, right? You know, and that's not an option for you to raise that capital in one lick. You know, being very thoughtful, how I see it work sort of on the ground is, you know, entrepreneurs and investors being very thoughtful about, okay, what does, you know, 2 million get you, right? And it may not get you certainly to prototype level. It may get you some de-risking of, I don't know, headset penetration in your target market. It may get you, you know, some initial content on your head, you know, whatever the milestones are, but really trying to be very thoughtful about sort of chunking down the ambition into sort of very digestible pieces, and then sort of entrepreneurs and investors looking at themselves and saying, you know, what can we stomach here early on? And, you know, what are the biggest risks to the business and how can we get signals on those risks while not, you know, sort of barking, you know, putting the cart before the horse and trying to take this whole thing down in one lick, right? And so in terms of trying to give feedback to entrepreneurs that may face that issue, I would really be focusing on, you know, really find the first and second derivative of your kind of ambition, right? Like really chunk it down into those milestones and try to figure out, you know, what milestones can we fund and you know, how much is it really going to take to do that? So not always easy, but you know, I think that's the approach that I try to take anyway.
Yeah, but you know, I'll my caution to entrepreneurs who are trying to do this is they're very, today, given where venture capital is, there are very, very, very few VCs who know how to do fat startups, who are willing to do fat startups. There are, you know, if you look at the history of the venture capital industry, there was lots of fat startup activity going on at one point. That's how the whole infrastructure of the technology industry has been built. Chips, networking equipment, routers, you know, there were all kinds of hardware investments that were done earlier on in the industry, which were fat startups, and people were willing to do fat startups. People knew how to do fat startups. People knew that it takes investment to build, you know, intense technology, and engineers are expensive and takes time and all of that stuff. That whole knowledge and that whole, you know, patient investor category basically has disappeared, and we don't see that in consumer technologies. In consumer investors, we hardly see that anymore, and even in enterprise investors, we don't hardly see it anymore. Right now, the expectation is that somehow or the other, the entrepreneur is going to be scrappy and figure out a way to do, you know, what they want to do on their own dime, and then they're going to basically, the VCs are going to basically come to the rescue of victory.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously you have this catch-22 situation as an entrepreneur where, you know, the VC wants to see traction, but, you know, you're not able to get that traction without, you know, a team and a product, and a team and a product take funding, and they're not going to give you funding without traction. So, but, you know, I think, again, it comes down to, I think it's really hard to look at, one thing I've learned both as an entrepreneur and a VC is that it's really hard to look at VC as this sort of homogenous group, because, and the reason for that is it only takes one VC to say yes for you to close a round, right? And so it's sort of, being precise about the VCs that you want to work with and meet matters, right? And so, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, 19 people can, you know, 19 VCs can say no, and, you know, the 20th one says yes, and that's all you need, right? And,
yeah, no, I don't, you know, agree with that at all, because then you basically have a terrible time raising the follow-on rounds. That's where you're absolutely wrong, because it's not a question of raising one round. There's a question of raising multiple rounds, and this is where the Series A gap is gaping, and you have, you know, 70,000 seed-funded companies, and only 1,200 companies get venture funding. So it's, I don't think I agree with you at all. And you're talking about, you know, very specialized expertise in some of these cases, and these kind of expensive technology building challenges, and this whole gap in early stage financing that makes fat startups really difficult to build. So it's a very serious problem, and I've thought a lot about it, because I, you know, this is what I do for, like, day in and day out. This is what I do. This is what I am constantly thinking about, and it's a really serious problem in the industry.
So So, you know, agree to disagree. I will say that, you know, when you're starting a company, you are trying to be the exception in every possible way, right? And so I absolutely disagree that you can sort of paint this picture in a general sense and say, you know, VC is X. I think on average you can say that, but, you know, I could name 50, you know, I know a gazillion hardware VCs that do great work, and you know, so you know, there are always exceptions. As a startup, you are trying to be the exception, and on the VC side, there are always exceptions. For 10 VCs that say we want to see traction, there are, you know, one or two that are happy myself included, funding back of a napkin projects, right? For every 10 VCs that say we won't fund hardware, there are three that say we love hardware and we'll only do hardware. So I completely push back on the fact that, you know, you can look at VC as, you know, it's like me saying, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, are greedy, or entrepreneurs, like, it's just these generalizations, I think, don't necessarily help. And I think that, you know, as an entrepreneur, it's your job to find the business partners on the financing side that share your vision, and not everyone will, but, you know, I guarantee you that there are people out there that do, so.
Yeah, okay, we agree to disagree. Good talking to you. I think it's a very, very good discussion, so I think people will find interesting nuggets out of it in the on the readership side.
Absolutely, yeah. Let me know if I can be helpful. Good to meet you, by the way. I don't think we've ever crossed paths in person, but hope to do so at some point.
Yeah, likewise, absolutely. And I enjoyed the discussion very much, and it's a very worthwhile discussion to have. And I think I've been frustrated for many years now that the fashion, you know, technology side is still not moving. You know, it took a while for consumers to start transacting on fashion merchandise online, but that kind of flipped around the mid-2000s, late-2000s, and now that's a pretty significant market. But the technology side and the personalization side, and VR is even, you know, much later technology, but the personalization side, I thought by now would have come together, and it hasn't. So that, and I thought a lot about why it hasn't, and I think these are the analysis that I provided you with, especially the combination of skills of understanding fashion and understanding technology at sufficient depth is missing.
I think that's right. Cool. We'll hope to continue the conversation in person.
Yeah. Soon. Keep in touch. Bye.
Okay. See you soon. Bye.